You. Where are you going? Out. She met Yoshi Tamizu at his apartment. They had begun their affair a year before and had resumed it again in Geneva. Yoshi had a wife and child in Tokyo, and he would be returning there in the fall. So it was just a friendship with privileges.
You feel tense,
he said, stroking her back. He had wonderful hands.
Did you argue with Richard?
Not really. A bit. She looked at the moonlight coming in through the window, surprisingly bright.
Then what is it?
Yoshi asked.
I'm worried about Gerard. Why?
Richard hates him.
Really hates him. Oh, he wouldn't do anything. It's such a valuable animal.
He might, she said. She sat up in bed.
Maybe I should go back.
Yoshi shrugged.
If you think. I'm sorry, she said.
He kissed her lightly.
Do what you think is best.
Gail sighed.
You're right, she said. I'm being silly.
She slid back down under the covers.
Tell me I'm being silly. Please.
Brad Gordon clicked off the TV and yelled, It's open! Come in! It was noon. He was lounging in his third-floor apartment in Sherman Oaks, watching the ball game and waiting for the pizza delivery guy. But to his surprise, the door opened and in walked the best-looking woman he had ever seen in his life. She had elegance written all over her. 30-ish, tall, slim, European clothing, heels that were not too high. Sexy, but in control. Brad sat forward in his lounger chair and ran his hand over his chin, feeling the stubble.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't expect any visitors.
Your uncle, Mr. Watson, sent me,
the woman said, walking directly toward him. He hastened to stand.
My name is Maria Gonzalez.
She had a slight accent, but it didn't sound Spanish, more German.
I'm involved with the firm that does your uncle's investment work,
she said, shaking his hand. Brad nodded, inhaling her light perfume. He wasn't surprised to hear she worked for Uncle Jack. The old guy surrounded himself with good-looking, extremely competent businesswomen. He said, What can I do for you, Ms. Gonzalez?
Nothing for me,
she answered smoothly, looking around the apartment for a place to sit. She decided to remain standing.
But you can do something for your uncle.
Well, sure. Anything.
I don't need to remind you that your uncle has paid your bail and will be assuming the cost of your legal defense. Since the charge involves sex with a minor, the defense will be difficult.
But I was set up.
She raised her hand.
It's none of my affair. The point is this. Your uncle has helped you many times over the years. Now he needs your help, confidentially, in return.
Uncle Jack needs my help?
He does.
Okay, sure.
In strict confidence.
Right, yes.
You will discuss this with no one, ever.
Right, understood.
Word of this must never get out. If it did, you would lose your legal defense funding. You'd spend 20 years in prison as a child molester. You know what that means?
Yes. He wiped his hands on his trousers. I understand.
No screw-ups this time, Brad.
Okay. Just tell me what you want me to do.
Your favorite company, Biogen, is about to announce an important new discovery, a gene that cures drug addiction. It's the first step toward a huge commercial product, and it will attract a lot of financing. Your uncle currently holds a large position in the company, and he does not want his position diluted by additional investors. He wants them scared off.
Yes?
By some bad news coming out of Biogen.
What kind of bad news?
At the moment, Maria Gonzalez said, Biogen's most important commercial product consists of a cell line, the Burnett line, which the company bought from UCLA, the cell line produces cytokines, important in cancer treatment.
Yeah.
Contamination of those cell lines would be disastrous. She reached into her purse and brought out a small plastic bottle of a well-known brand of eye drops. The bottle contained clear liquid. She unscrewed the cap and put a single drop of liquid on the tip of each finger of her other hand. Got it?
Yes, he said.
One drop on each finger. Let it dry.
Okay.
Go into Biogen. Your swipe cards still work. Check the database for storage locations and research lockers containing the Burnett line. The storage number is on this card. She handed him a small card with the number BGOX617-8990QD. There are frozen samples, and there are live in vitro incubators. You go to each one and just touch them.
Just touch them? Brad looked at the bottle. What is that stuff?
Nothing that will hurt you, but the cells won't like it.
The security cameras will record me. Card swipes are recorded. They'll know who did it.
Not if you go between 1 and 2 a.m. The systems are down for backup.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are. This week only.
Brad took the plastic bottle from her and turned it over in his hand.
You realize, he said, they have off-site storage for that cell line, too.
Just do what your uncle asks, she said, and leave the rest to him.
She closed her purse.
And one final thing. Do not call or contact your uncle about this or any other matter. He wants no record of any contact with you. Clear?
Clear.
Good luck. And on behalf of your uncle, thank you.
She shook his hand again and left.
No blonde extinction after all. BBC reported false story, absent fact check. No WHO study, no German study. A bad blonde joke for 150 years. The World Health Organization, WHO, today denied it had ever conducted or published any study predicting the extinction of the blonde-haired gene. According to the UN group spokesman, WHO has no knowledge of how these news reports originated, but would like to stress that we have no opinion on the future existence of blondes. According to the Washington Post, the BBC story stemmed from a German wire service account. That story, in turn, was based on an article published 2 years before in the German women's magazine Allegra, which cited a WHO anthropologist as its source, but no record of the anthropologist exists. The story would never have run, said Georgetown media professor Len Euler, if even minimal fact-checking had been done by BBC editors. Some media observers noted that news organizations no longer check anything. We just publish the press release and move on, one reporter observed. Another reporter, speaking on condition of anonymity, said, let's face it, it's a good story. Accuracy would kill it. Further inquiry by the urban legend site Snopes.com uncovered multiple versions of the extinct blonde story going back 150 years to the time of Abraham Lincoln. In every instance, scientific validity was claimed to bolster the story's credibility. A typical example dates from 1906. Blondes doomed to vanish from Earth. Major Woodruff sounds their death knell. It's science. The girl with the golden tresses is doomed. And within 600 years, blondes will be extinct. The fate of the blonde was foretold today by Major C.E. Woodruff in a lecture at the Association for the Advancement of Science at Columbia University. Clearly, blondes will not become extinct, but neither will the news stories that predict their demise, since the stories have been repeated for a century and a half with no basis whatsoever, said Professor Yule. Henry Kendall's wife, Lynn, designed websites for a living, so she was usually at home during the day.
Around 3 p.m, she got an odd call.
"This is Dr. Marty Roberts at Long Beach Memorial," a voice said. "Is Henry there?"
"He's at a soccer game," she said. "Can I take a message?"
I called his office, and I called his cell, but there was no answer.
Dr. Roberts' tone made it sound urgent.
"I'll see Henry in an hour," Lynn said. "Is he all right, Dr. Roberts?"
"Oh, sure, he's fine. He's perfectly fine. Just ask him to call me, would you?" Lynn said she would.
Later, when Henry came home, she went into the kitchen, where he was getting cookies and milk for their 8-year-old son, Jamie. Lynn said,
"Do you know somebody at Long Beach Memorial Hospital?"
Henry blinked.
"Did he call?"
"This afternoon. Who is he?"
"He's a friend of mine from school. A pathologist. What did he say?"
"Nothing. He wanted you to call him back."
She somehow managed not to ask her husband what it was all about.
"Okay," he said. "Thanks."
She saw Henry glance at the phone in the kitchen, then turn on his heel and walk into the little study that they both shared.
He closed the door.
She heard him speaking softly on the phone. She couldn't make out the words. Jamie was eating his snack. Tracy, their 13-year-old, was playing her music very loud upstairs. Lynn yelled up the stairway, "A little less noise, please!" Tracy didn't hear her. There was nothing to do but go upstairs and tell her. When she came back down, Henry was in the living room, pacing.
"I have to take a trip," he said.
"Okay, where?"
"I have to go to Bethesda."
"Something at the NIH?"
The National Institutes of Health were in Bethesda. Henry went there a couple of times a year for conferences.
"Yes."
She watched him pace.
"Henry," she said, "are you going to tell me what this is about?"
"I just have some research. I just have to check on something. I'm not sure."
"You have to go to Bethesda, but you're not sure why?"
"Well, of course I'm sure. It's to do with Bellarmino."
Robert Bellarmino was the head of genetics at NIH and no friend of her husband.
"What about him?"
"I have to, deal with something he has done."
She sat down in a chair.
"Henry," she said, "I love you, but I am really confused here. Why aren't you telling me?"
"Look," he said, "I don't want to talk about it. I just have to go back there. That's all. Just for a day."
"Are you in trouble?"
"I said I don't want to talk about it, Lynn. I have to go back."
"Okay. When?"
"Tomorrow."
She nodded slowly.
"All right. Do you want me to book?"
"I've already done it. I have it handled."
He stopped pacing and went over to her.
"Look," he said, "I don't want you to worry." "That's pretty hard, under the circumstances."
"It's fine," he said. "It's just something I have to take care of, and then it'll be taken care of."
And that was all he would say. Lynn had been married to Henry for 15 years. They had 2 children together. She knew better than anyone that Henry was prone to nervous tics and flights of fancy. The same imaginative leaps that made him such a good researcher also made him a bit of a hysteric. He was inclined to frequent self-diagnoses of dreaded diseases. He visited his doctor every couple of weeks and telephoned more often than that. He was plagued by aches, itches, rashes, and sudden fears that woke him in the middle of the night. He dramatized small concerns. A minor accident was a brush with death, the way Henry told it. So even though his behavior about a trip to Bethesda was odd, she was inclined to regard it as probably minor. She glanced at her watch and decided it was time to defrost the spaghetti sauce for dinner. She didn't want Jamie eating too many cookies or it would spoil his appetite. Tracy had turned her music up louder again. In short, daily events took over and pushed Henry and his odd trip from her mind. She had other things to do, and she did them. Henry Kendall left Dulles Airport and drove north on 267, heading toward the primate facility in Lambertville. It was almost an hour before he saw the chain-link fence and the guardhouse behind the double gates.
Beyond the gates, he saw huge maple trees that obscured the complex of buildings farther back. Lambertville was one of the largest primate research facilities in the world, but the national institutes did not publicize that fact or its location, partly because primate research was so politically charged and partly out of concern for vandalism by activists. Henry pulled up at the outer gate, pushed the button, and said, "Henry Kendall," and gave his code number. He hadn't been there for 4 years, but the code was still good. He leaned out of the car so the camera could see his face clearly.
"Thank you, Dr. Kendall."
The gate opened. He pulled through to the second gate, the first closed behind him. A guard came out and checked his ID. He vaguely remembered the guy.
"Didn't expect you today, Dr. Kendall."
He handed him a temporary swipe card.
"They want me to clear some things out from my storage locker."
"Yeah, I'll bet. Things are getting tighter around here since, you know."
"Yeah, I know."
He meant Bellarmino. The inner gate opened and Henry drove through. He passed the admin building and went straight to the holding facilities. The chimps were formerly in Building B. He assumed they still were. He opened the outer door and swiped his card on the inner door. He went down a corridor to the B monitor room. It was a room filled with display screens, showing all the chimpanzees on 2 floors of the facility. There were about 80 animals of various ages and sexes. The on-duty veterinary assistant was there, in khaki uniform, but also there was Rovac, the head of the facility. He must have been notified by the front gate. Rovac was 50, steel-gray hair, military bearing, but he was a good scientist.
"I wondered when you'd show up," Rovac said.
He shook hands. He seemed friendly. "You got the blood?"
"Yes,"
Henry nodded.
"Fucking Bellarmino had a cow," Rovac said. "He hasn't been out here yet, and we think we know why."
"What do you mean?"
Henry said.
"Let's take a walk,"
Rovac said. Henry consulted his paper.
"I'm looking for female F-402.
"No,"
Rovac said. "You're looking for the offspring of female F-402.
He's this way."
They started down a side corridor. This led to a small training facility that was used for short-term teaching experiments with animals.
"You keep him here?"
"Have to. You'll see."
They came into the training facility. At first glance, it looked like a kindergarten playroom, brightly colored toys scattered around, blue carpet on the floor. A casual visitor might not notice that the toys were all made of high-impact, durable plastic. There were observation glass walls on one side. Mozart was playing over the speakers.
"Likes Mozart,"
Rovac said, shrugging. They went into a smaller room off to the side. A shaft of sunlight came down from the ceiling. There was a 5x5 cage in the center. Inside sat a young chimpanzee, about the size of a 4-year-old child. The chimp's face was flatter than usual, and the skin was pale, but it was clearly a chimp.
"Hello, Dave," Rovac said.
"Hello,"
the chimp said.
His voice was raspy. He turned to Henry. "Are you my mother?"
he said. Henry Kendall could not speak. His jaw moved, but no words came out. Rovac said,
"Yes, he is, Dave."
He turned to Kendall.
"His name is Dave."
The chimp was staring at Henry, just staring silently, sitting there in the cage, holding his toes in his fingers.
"I know it's a shock,"
Rovac said.
"Think how people here felt. When they found out, Vet almost passed out. Nobody had any idea he was different until out of the blue he came up negative on a sialic acid test. They repeated it because they assumed it was an error. But it wasn't an error. And then he started talking about 3 months ago."
Henry sighed.
"He speaks well," Rovac said. "Has a little trouble with verb tenses, but nobody has been instructing him. In fact, he's been kept away from everybody around here. You want to let him out?"
Kendall hesitated.
"Is he,
Chimps could be nasty and aggressive. Even small ones might be dangerous.
Oh, sure, he's very docile. He's not a chimp, right?
He opened the cage.
Come on out, Dave.
Dave came out hesitantly, like a man released from jail. He seemed frightened to be outside the cage. He looked at Henry.
Am I going to live with you?
I don't know, Henry said.
I don't like the cage.
He reached out and took Henry's hand.
Can we go play?
They went into the playroom. Dave led. Henry said,
Is this his routine?
Right. He gets about an hour a day, mostly with the vet, sometimes me.
Dave went over to the toys and began to arrange them into shapes, a circle, then a square.
I'm glad you came to see him, Rovac said. I think it's important.
What's going to happen to him?
What do you think? This is illegal as shit, Henry. A transgender higher primate? You know, Hitler tried to cross a human and a chimp, and Stalin tried. You might say they defined the field. Let's see, Hitler, Stalin, and now an American researcher at the NIH? No way, my friend.
So what are you...
This represents an unauthorized experiment. It has to be terminated.
Are you kidding?
You're in Washington, Rovac said, and you're looking at political dynamite. NIH funding is already flat from the current administration. It'd be cut to a tenth if word of this got out.
But this animal is extraordinary, Henry said.
But unauthorized, that's all anybody cares about. Rovac shook his head. Don't get sentimental. You have a transgenic experiment that was never authorized, and the rules state explicitly that any experiment not approved by the boards will be terminated, and there will be no exceptions.
What will you,
Morphine drip intravenously. Won't feel a thing, Rovac said. You don't need to worry. We'll take good care of him. And after incineration, there will be no evidence at all that it ever happened.
He nodded to Dave.
Why don't you go play with him for a while? He'd like the company. He's bored with all of us.
They played a sort of impromptu game of checkers, using toy blocks, jumping over each other while they both sat on the floor. Henry noticed details. Dave's hands, which were the proportion of human hands, his feet, which were prehensile like a chimp's, his eyes, which had flecks of blue, and his smile, which was not quite human, not quite ape-like.
This is fun, Dave said.
That's because you are winning. Henry didn't really understand the rules, but he thought he should let Dave win. That's what he had done with his own kids. And then he thought, this is my own kid. He wasn't thinking clearly. He knew that. He was acting by instinct. He was aware of watching intently as Dave was returned to his cage, of the way he was locked in with a key press padlock, of the way...
Let me shake his hand again, Henry said. Open it up again.
Look, Rovac said, don't do this to yourself or him. I just want to shake his hand. Rovac sighed, unlocked the lock. Henry watched. 01, 05, 04. He shook Dave's hand and said goodbye.
Are you coming tomorrow?
Dave said.
Soon,
Henry said. Dave turned away, not looking at him as Henry left the room and closed the door.
Listen, Rovac said, you ought to be grateful you're not being prosecuted and thrown into jail. Now don't be foolish about this. We'll handle it. You go on about your business.
Okay,
Henry said. Thank you. He asked to stay at the facility until it was time for his plane home. They put him in a room with a terminal for researchers. He spent the afternoon reading about Dave and all the annotations in his file. He printed the entire file out. He walked around the facility, went to the bathroom several times so that the guards would be accustomed to seeing him on the monitors. Rovac went home at 4, stopping in to say goodbye on his way out. The vets and guards changed shifts at 6. At 5:30 p.m.,
Henry went back into the training facility and headed straight for Dave's room. He unlocked the cage.
"Hello, Mother,"
Dave said.
"Hi, Dave. Would you like to take a trip?"
"Yes,"
Dave said.
"Okay. Do exactly what I say."
Researchers frequently walked with the tamer chimps, sometimes holding their hands. Henry walked with Dave down the training corridor, moving at a casual pace, ignoring the cameras. They turned left into the main corridor and headed for the exterior door. He swiped the inner door, led Dave through, and opened the outer door. As he expected, there were no alarms. The Lambertville facility had been designed to keep intruders out and to keep animals from escaping, but not to prevent researchers from removing animals. Indeed, for a variety of reasons, researchers sometimes needed to remove animals without going through extensive red tape. And so it was that Henry put Dave on the floor of the back seat of his car and drove to the exit gate. It was now shift change, with a lot of cars coming and going. Henry turned in his swipe card and his badge. The guard on duty said,
"Thanks, Dr. Kendall,"
and Henry drove out into the rolling green hills of western Maryland.
"You're driving back,"
Lynn said.
"Why?"
"It's a long story."
"Why, Henry?"
"I have no choice. I have to drive."
"Henry," she said, "you're behaving very strangely, you know that."
"It was a moral issue."
"What moral issue?"
"I have a responsibility."
"What responsibility? God damn it, Henry."
"Honey," he said, "it's a long story."
"You said that."
"Believe me, I want to tell you everything," he said. "I really do. But it'll have to wait until I get home."
Dave said, "Is that your mother?"
Lynn said,
"Who's in the car with you?"
"Nobody."
"Who was talking? That raspy voice?"
"I really can't explain it," he said. "You'll just have to wait until I get home, and then you'll understand."
"Henry."
"Gotta go, Lynn. Love to the kids." He hung up. Dave was watching him with patient eyes.
"Was that your mother?"
"No. Somebody else."
"Is she angry?"
"No, no. Are you hungry, Dave?"
"Soon."
"Okay. We'll find a drive-in. But meantime, you have to wear your seatbelt."
Dave looked puzzled. Henry pulled over and clipped the seatbelt around him. It didn't really fit. He was only slightly larger than a child.
"I don't like it."
He started to tug at the harness.
"You have to wear it."
"No."
"Sorry."
"I want to go back."
"Can't go back, Dave."
Dave stopped struggling. He stared out the window.
"It's dark."
Henry ran his hand over the animal's head, feeling the short fur. He could feel Dave relax when he did it.
"It's okay, Dave. Everything is going to be fine now."
Henry pulled back onto the road and headed west.
"What are you talking about?"
Lynn Kendall said, staring at Dave, who sat quietly on the living room couch.
"This monkey is your son?"
"Well, not exactly."
"Not exactly?"
She paced around the living room.
"What the hell does that mean, Henry?"
It had been a normal Saturday afternoon. Their teenage daughter, Tracy, was in the backyard, sunbathing and talking on the telephone and not doing her homework. Her brother, Jamie, was splashing in the wading pool. Lynn had spent the day inside the house, finishing a job on a tight deadline. She'd been working hard on it for the last 3 days, so she was surprised when she opened the front door and her husband had walked in, leading a chimpanzee by the hand.
"Henry! Is he your son or not?"
"He is, in a way."
"In a way. That's clear. I'm glad you cleared that up."
She spun, glared at him. An awful thought occurred to her.
"Wait a minute.
Wait just a minute. Are you trying to tell me that you had sex with a...
No, no, her husband said, holding up his hands. No, honey, nothing like that. It was just an experiment.
Just an experiment? Jesus, an experiment? What kind of experiment, Henry?
The monkey sat curled up, holding his toes in his hand, looking up at the two adults.
Try to keep your voice down, Henry said. You're upsetting him.
I'm upsetting him. I'm upsetting him? He's a fucking monkey, Henry!
Ape.
Ape, monkey. Henry, what is he doing here? Why is he in our house?
Well, I'm not... Actually, he's come to live with us.
He's come to live with us. Out of the blue.
You have a monkey son, and you never knew about it. He just suddenly arrives with you.
Great. That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. Anybody can understand that. Why didn't you tell me, Henry?
Oh, never mind. Let it be a surprise. I'm driving home with my monkey son, but I'll tell you about it when I walk in the door.
That's great, Henry. I'm glad we had all those therapy sessions about intimacy and communications.
Lynn, I'm sorry.
You're always sorry, Henry. What are you going to do with him? Are you going to take him to the zoo or what?
I don't like the zoo, Dave said, speaking for the first time.
I didn't ask you, Lynn said. You keep out of this.
And then she froze. She turned. She stared.
He talks.
Yes, Dave said.
Are you my mother?
Lynn Kendall didn't actually pass out, but she began to tremble, and when her knees buckled, Henry caught her and helped her to sit in her favorite chair facing the coffee table next to the couch. Dave didn't move. He just stared with wide eyes. Henry went into the kitchen and got his wife some lemonade and brought it back to her.
Here, he said. Drink this.
I want a damn martini.
Honey, those days are over.
Lynn was AA.
I don't know what days are what, she said.
She was staring at Dave.
He talks. The monkey talks.
Ape.
I'm sorry I upsetted you,
Dave said to her.
Thank you,
His name is Dave, Henry said. He doesn't always get his tenses right.
Dave said,
Sometimes people get upsetted by me. They feel bad.
Dave,
she said,
this is not about you, honey. You seem to be very nice.
This is about him.
She jerked her thumb toward Henry. The asshole.
What is asshole?
He's probably never heard swearing, Henry said. You need to watch your language.
How do you watch language? Dave said. It's noises. You can't watch noises.
I'm very confused,
Lynn said, sinking into her chair.
It's an expression, Henry said. A figure of speech.
Oh, I see,
Dave said. There was a silence. His wife sighed. Henry patted her arm.
Do you have any trees?
Dave said.
I like to climb trees.
At that moment, Jamie came into the house.
Hey, Mom, I need a towel.
He broke off and stared at the chimp.
Hello?
Dave said. Jamie blinked, recovered fast.
Hey, neat, he said. I'm Jamie.
My name is Dave. Do you have any trees to climb?
Sure, a big one. Come on.
Jamie headed for the door. Dave looked questioningly at Lynn and Henry.
Go ahead, Henry said. It's okay.
Dave leapt off the couch and scampered to the door, following Jamie.
How do you know he won't run away?
Lynn said. I don't think he will.
Because he's your son.
The door banged shut. Outside, they heard their daughter screaming and shrieking.
What is that?
They heard Jamie say, He's a chimp, and we're climbing trees.
Where'd you get him, Jamie?
He's Dad's.
Does he bite?
They couldn't make out Jamie's answer, but through the window they saw the tree branches swaying and moving, giggles and laughter from outside.
What are you going to do with him?
Lynn said. I don't know, Henry said.
Well, he can't stay here.
I know that.
I won't have a dog in the house. I certainly won't have an ape.
I know.
And because there's no room for him.
I know.
This is really a mess, she said.
He said nothing, just nodded.
How the hell did this happen, Henry?
She said. It's a long story, he said.
I'm listening.
When the human genome was decoded, he explained, scientists discovered that the genome of a chimpanzee was nearly identical to that of a man.
All that separates our two species, he said, is 500 genes.
Of course, that number was deceptive, because human beings and sea urchins also shared a lot of genes. In fact, nearly every creature on the planet shared tens of thousands of the same genes. There was a great underlying unity of all life, genetically speaking. So that created a lot of interest in what had caused the differences in different species. 500 genes weren't a lot, yet a great chasm seemed to separate chimps from human beings.
Many species can crossbreed to produce hybrids. Lions and tigers, leopards and jaguars, dolphins and whales, buffalo and cattle, zebras and horses, camels and llamas, grizzlies and polar bears sometimes mate in the wild, producing growlers. So there was a question of whether chimps and humans could hybridize to make a human Z. The answer seems to be no.
Somebody has tried?
Many times, starting back to the 1920s.
But even if hybridization were impossible, Henry explained, one might still insert human genes directly into a chimp embryo to create a transgenic animal. 4 years back, when Henry was on sabbatical at the National Institutes of Health, he was studying autism, and he wanted to know which genes might account for the difference in communication abilities between people and apes.
Because chimps can communicate, he said. They have a range of cries and hand gestures. They can organize themselves into very effective hunting parties to kill small animals. So they have communication, but no language, like severe autistics. That's what interested me.
And what did you do?
His wife asked.
In the laboratory, under a microscope, he inserted human genes into a chimpanzee embryo. His own genes.
Including the genes for speech?
She asked. Actually, all of them.
You inserted all your genes?
Look, I never expected the experiment to go to term, he said. I was looking to retrieve a fetus.
A fetus, not an animal.
If the transgenic fetus survived 8 or 9 weeks before it spontaneously aborted, there would be enough differentiation that he could dissect the fetus and advance his understanding of speech in apes.
You expected the fetus to die?
Yes. I was just hoping that it would carry long enough.
And then you were going to cut the fetus up?
Dissect it, yes.
Your own genes. Your own fetus. You did this in order to have something to dissect?
She was looking at him like he was a monster.
Lynn, it was an experiment. We do this kind of thing all the...
He broke off. No point going there.
Look,
he said, the genes were close at hand. I didn't have to get anybody's permission to use them.
It was an experiment. It wasn't about me.
It is now, she said.
The question Henry was trying to answer was fundamental. Chimps and humans had split from a common ancestor 6 million years ago, and scientists had long ago noticed that chimpanzees most closely resemble human beings at their fetal stage, This suggested that human beings differed from chimps in part because of difference in intrauterine development. Human development could be thought of as having been arrested at the chimp fetal stage. Some scientists felt it was related to the eventual growth of the human brain, which doubled in the first year after birth. But Henry's interest was in speech, and for speech to occur, the vocal cords had to move down the throat from the mouth, creating a voice box. That happened in humans, but not in chimps. The entire developmental sequence was immensely complicated. Henry hoped to harvest a transgenic fetus and from that to gain some knowledge of what drove the change in human development that made speech possible. At least, that was his original experimental plan.
"Why didn't you remove the fetus as you intended?" she asked him.
Because that summer, several chimps contracted viral encephalitis, and the healthy chimps had to be moved away for quarantine. They were taken to different labs around the East Coast. I never heard anything about the embryo I implanted. I just assumed that the female had spontaneously aborted in a quarantine facility somewhere, and the fetal material was discarded. I couldn't inquire too closely.
Because what you did was illegal.
Well, that's a strong word. I assumed the experiment had failed, and it was over.
Guess not.
No, he said. I guess not. What happened was that the female gave birth to a full-term infant, and the two were returned to Bethesda. The infant chimp appeared to be normal in every respect. Its skin was somewhat pale, especially around the mouth, where there was no hair. But chimps varied widely in the amount of pigmentation they showed. No one thought anything of it. As the infant grew, it appeared less normal. The face, which was originally flat, did not bulge outward with age. The facial features remained rather infantile. Still, nobody thought to question the baby's appearance, until they discovered on a routine blood exam that the infant tested negative for the GC sialic acid enzyme. Since all apes carry this enzyme, the test was obviously wrong and repeated. It again came back negative. The infant chimp did not have the enzyme.
"Absence of that enzyme is a human trait," Henry said. "Sialic acid is a kind of sugar. No humans have the GC form of sialic acid. All apes have it."
"But this infant didn't."
"Right.
So they did a DNA panel and quickly realized that the infant didn't have the usual 1.5% difference in genes from a human being. It had many fewer differences, and they started to put it all together."
"And tested the chimp's DNA against everybody who had worked in the lab?"
"Yes."
"And found he matched your DNA?"
"Yes. Bellarmino's office sent me a sample a few weeks ago, I guess to give me a heads up."
"What did you do?"
"Took it to a friend for analysis."
"Your friend in Long Beach?"
"Yes."
"And Bellarmino?"
"He just doesn't want to be responsible when word gets out." He shook his head. "I was driving home and I was just west of Chicago when I got a call from this guy, Rovac, at the animal lab, and he says, 'You're on your own with this one, pal.' That's their attitude. My problem, not theirs."
Lynn frowned. "Why isn't this a major discovery? Shouldn't this make you famous around the world? You've created the first transgenic ape."
"The problem," Henry said, "is that I can be censured for it, or even put in jail, because I didn't have permission from the committees that oversee primate research, because the NIH now forbids transgenic work on any animal other than rats, because all the anti-GM wackos and Frankenfood nuts will be up in arms over this, because the NIH doesn't want any involvement in this and will deny any knowledge of it."
"So you can't tell anyone where Dave came from?"
"That's a problem, Henry. Because you'll never keep him a secret."
"I know," he said miserably.
"Tracy's on the phone right now. telling all her friends about the cute little ape in her backyard.
Yes.
Her girlfriends will be over here in a few minutes. How are you going to explain Dave to them? Because after the girls will come the reporters.
Lynn glanced at her watch.
In 1-2 hours, max. What'll you say?
I don't know. Maybe I'll say the work was done in another country, in China or in South Korea, and they sent him here.
And what will Dave say when the reporters talk to him?
I'll ask him not to talk to them.
Reporters won't leave this alone, Henry. They'll be camped outside the house with long lenses. They'll be circling in helicopters overhead. They'll be on the next plane to China or Korea to talk to the person who did this. And when they don't find that person, then what?
She stared at him, then walked to the door. She looked into the backyard where Dave was playing with Jamie, the two of them yelling and swinging through the trees. She was silent for a moment. Then she said,
"You know, his skin really is quite pale."
"I know."
"His face is flat, almost human.
What would he look like with a haircut?"
And so was born Gandler-Crookheim syndrome, a rare genetic mutation causing short stature, excessive body hair, and facial deformities that yielded a rather ape-like appearance. The syndrome was so rare it had only been documented 4 times in the last century. First, in an aristocratic Hungarian family in Budapest in 1923. 2 children were born with the syndrome, described in the medical literature by an Austrian physician, Dr. Emil Krukheim. The second appearance occurred in an Inuit child born in northern Alaska in 1944. A third child, a girl, was born in Sao Paulo in 1957, but she died of infection a few weeks after birth. A 4th child in Bruges, Belgium, in 1988, was briefly seen by media, but subsequently vanished. His whereabouts were now unknown.
"I like this," Lynn said. She was typing on her portable.
"What's the name of that hairy syndrome? Excessive familial hairiness?"
"Hypertrichosis," Henry said.
"Right," she kept typing. "So Gandler-Crookheim is related to hypertrichosis. Actually, congenital hypertrichosis langanosa. And there have only been 50 cases reported in the last 400 years.
"Are you writing that or reading that?"
"Both,"
she sat back.
"Okay," she said. "That's all I need for now. You better go tell Dave."
"Tell him what?"
"That he's human.
He probably thinks he is anyway."
"Okay."
As Henry walked to the door, he said, "You really think this will work?"
"I know it will," Lynn said. "California has laws against invading the privacy of special children. Many of these kids have serious deformities. They've got enough challenges growing up and going to school without the added burden of media exposure. Big fines if the media do it. They won't."
"Maybe," he said.
"It's the best we can do for now," she said.
She was typing again.
He paused at the door.
"If Dave is a human being," he said, "we can't very well send him to a circus."
"Oh, no,"
Lynn said.
"No, no. Dave lives with us. He's part of our family now. Thanks to you, we have no choice."
Henry went outside. Tracy and her friends were standing beneath the tree, pointing into the branches.
"Look at the monkey! Look at him!"
"No," Henry said to them. "He's not a monkey, and please, don't embarrass him.
Dave suffers from a rare genetic syndrome, and he explained it to them as they listened wide-eyed. Jamie had a trundle bed that he used when friends slept over. Lynn pulled it out, and Dave slept on it alongside Jamie. His last words were, "It's very soft," and almost immediately he was asleep, while Lynn ran her hand soothingly through his hair. Jamie said, "This is so neat, Mom. It's like having a brother." "It is, isn't it?" she said. She turned out the light and closed the door. When she looked back in on them later, she found that Dave had twisted his sheets into a circle around him, making a kind of nest in the middle of the bed.
"No,"
Tracy said, standing in the kitchen, hands on hips.
"No, he cannot live in our house. How could you do this to me, Dad?"
"Do what?"
"You know what the other kids are going to say? He's a monkey that looks like a person, Dad, and he sounds like you with a stuffy nose."
She was near tears.
"He's related to you, isn't he? He has your genes."
"Now, Tracy,
I am so embarrassed."
She started to sob.
"I had a chance to be a freshman cheerleader."
"Tracy," he said, "I'm sure you will."
"This was my year, Dad."
"It's still your year."
"Not if I have a monkey in my house."
She went to the refrigerator for a Coke, came back, still sobbing. That was when her mother walked in.
"He's not a monkey,"
Lynn said firmly.
"He is an unfortunate young boy who suffers from a serious disease."
"Oh, sure, Mom. Go look it up yourself. Google it."
"I will."
Still sobbing, she walked over to the computer. Henry glanced at Lynn, then moved to look over his daughter's shoulder.
"Hypertrichosis variant disorder reported 1923, Hungary. Gandler-Krukheim syndrome on Monday, 01 January 06 at 5:05 p.m. Doubtless, the hirsutism is secondary to QT/TD. The Hungarian cases showed no induration, according to 1923. Gandler-Krukheim syndrome, Inuit lawsuit, 1944. In the hectic days of World War II, the young Inuit boy suffering from Gandler-Krukheim in the northern Alaska town of Sanduk was treated by a local prostitute. Gives birth to ape child in Beijing. New China Post reports an infant with chimp-like hair and large hands and feet, born to a Mongolian prostitute who claims to have mated with a Russian ape for money. Question whether this is Gandler-Krukheim syndrome, extremely rare condition. The Delhi Monkey Man, a new case of Gandler-Krukheim? Hindustan Times reports a man with the appearance and agility of a monkey, able to leap from rooftop to rooftop, frightening local residents. 3,000 police called out to Gandler-Krukheim syndrome from Belgium. Looking like a monkey, the young boy's picture appeared widely in the Brussels press, as well as publications in Paris and Bonn. After 1989, the child, whose name was Gilles, disappeared from public view. Translated, Syndrome Gandler-Krukheim de la Belgique ressemblant à un singe, l'image de jeune garçon est apparue partout dans la presse de Bruxelles comme les publications dispersées à Paris et à Bonn. Après 1989, l'enfant dont la nom était Gilles est disparu de la vue publique.
I had no idea, Tracy said, staring at the screen. There have only been 4 or 5 cases in all of history.
That poor kid.
He's very special, Henry said. I hope you will treat him better now. He put his hand on Tracy's shoulder and glanced back at his wife. All this in a couple of hours?
I've been busy, she said.
There were 50 reporters in the conference room of Shanghai's Hua Ting Hotel, sitting at row after row of green felt-covered tables. The TV cameras were all at the back of the room, and sitting on the floor up front were the cameramen with their bulky telephoto lenses. Strobes flashed as Professor Shen Zhizhong, head of the Institute of Biochemistry and Cell Biology in Shanghai, stepped up to the microphones. Wearing a black suit, Shen was a distinguished-looking man, and his English was excellent. Before becoming the head of IBCB, he had spent 10 years in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as a professor of cell biology at MIT.
I do not know whether I am telling you good news or bad news, he said, but I suspect it may be disappointing news. Nevertheless, I will set certain rumors finally to rest.
For some reason, he explained, rumors of unethical research in China began to circulate after the 12th East Asia Joint Symposium on Biomedical Research at Shaoxing City in Zhejiang Province.
I have no idea why, Shen said. The conference was quite ordinary and technical in nature.
However, at the next conference, in Seoul, reporters from Taiwan and Tokyo were asking pointed questions.
I was therefore advised by Baiyong J. Lee, the head of molecular biology at Seoul National University, to address this matter directly. He has some experience with the power of rumors.
There were knowing chuckles in the audience. Shen was referring, of course, to the worldwide scandal that had erupted around the eminent Korean geneticist Hwang Woo-suk.
Therefore, I shall come directly to the point, he said. For many years, there have been rumors that Chinese scientists were attempting to create a hybrid of human and chimpanzee. According to the story, back in 1967, a surgeon named Ji Yong Zhang fertilized a female chimpanzee with human sperm. The chimp was in the third month of pregnancy when outraged citizens stormed his lab and ended the experiment. The chimpanzee later died, but researchers at the Chinese Academy of Science supposedly said they would continue the research. Shin paused. That is the first story. It is entirely untrue. No chimpanzee was ever impregnated by Dr. Yong Zhang or anyone else in China. Nor has a chimpanzee been impregnated anywhere in the world. If it had happened, you would know about it. Then, in 1980, a new story circulated that Italian researchers had seen human-chimp embryos in a Beijing laboratory. I heard this story when I was a professor at MIT. I asked to meet the Italian researchers in question. They could never be found. They were always the friend of a friend.
Shen waited while strobes flashed again. The cameramen crawling around at his feet were annoying. After a moment, he continued.
Next, a few years ago, was the story that a Mongolian prostitute gave birth to a baby with the features of a chimpanzee. This chimp man was said to look like a human being, but was very hairy, with large hands and feet. The chimp man drank whiskey and spoke in sentences. According to the story, this chimp is now at the Chinese Space Agency headquarters in Chaoyang District. He can sometimes be seen at the windows, reading a newspaper and smoking a cigar. Supposedly, he will be sent to the moon because it is too dangerous to send a human. This story, too, is false. All the stories are false. I know these stories are tantalizing or amusing, but they are not true. Why they should be located in China, I am not sure, especially since the country with the least regulation of genetic experiments is the United States. You can do almost anything there. It was there that a gibbon was successfully mated with a siamang, primates that are genetically more distant than a human and chimp. Several live births resulted. This happened at Georgia State University almost 30 years ago. He then opened the floor to questions, according to the transcript.
Question. Dr. Shen, is the U.S. working on a chimp hybrid?
Dr. Shen,
I have no reason to think so. I am merely observing that the U.S. has the fewest rules.
Question. Is it possible to fertilize a chimpanzee with human sperm? Dr. Shen,
I would say no. That has been tried for nearly a century, going back to the 1920s, when Stalin ordered the most famous animal breeder in Russia to do it, to make a new race of soldiers for him. His name was Ivanov, and he failed and was thrown in jail. A few years later, Hitler's scientists tried it and also failed. Today we know that the genomes of humans and chimps are very close, but the uterine conditions are considerably different. So I would say no.
Question. Could it be done with genetic engineering?
Dr. Shen, that is difficult to say. It would be extremely difficult from a technical standpoint. From an ethical standpoint, I would say it is impossible.
Question. But an American scientist already applied to patent a human hybrid.
Dr. Shen. Professor Stuart Newman of New York was refused a patent on a part human hybrid, but he did not make a hybrid. Dr. Newman said he applied for the patent to draw attention to the ethical issues involved. The ethical issues remain unresolved.
Question.
Dr. Shen, do you think a hybrid will eventually be created?
Dr. Shen,
I called this press conference to end speculation, not to increase it. But if you ask my personal opinion, I think, yes, it will eventually be done.
The memory haunted Mark Sanger. The image burned in his mind of that poor animal, stranded on the beach at night in Costa Rica, helpless as the jaguar pounced, bit off her head, and proceeded to eat the flesh while her legs still kicked feebly, and all with the sound of crunching bones, the bones of her head. Mark Sanger had not expected to see anything so horrific. He had come to the beach at Tortuguero to witness the giant leatherback turtles crawling out of the ocean to lay their eggs in the sand. As a biologist, he knew this was a great migration the planet had witnessed for countless eons. The female turtles were engaged in one of the great demonstrations of maternal caring, crawling high onto the beach, depositing their eggs deep in the ground, covering them with exhausted flippers, then carefully sweeping the sand clean, obliterating any trace of the eggs beneath. It was a slow, gentle ceremony, directed by genes that survive from millennia past. Then came the jaguar, a black streak in the night, and suddenly last summer everything changed for Mark Sanger. The brutality of the attack, its speed and viciousness, shocked him profoundly. It confirmed his suspicion that the natural world had gone badly wrong. Everything that mankind was doing on the planet had upset the delicate balance of nature. The pollution, the rampant industrialization, the loss of habitat. When animals were squeezed and cornered, they behaved viciously in a desperate effort to survive. That was the explanation for the ghastly attack he had witnessed. The natural world was in collapse. He mentioned this to the very handsome naturalist Ramon Valdez, who had accompanied him. Valdez shook his head.
No, Señor Sanger, this is always the way it has been, since my father and grandfather before. They always spoke of the jaguar attacks in the night. It is part of the cycle of life.
But there are more attacks now, Sanger said, because of all the pollution.
No, Señor, there is no change. Every month, the jaguars take 2 to 4 turtles. We have records going back many years.
The violence we see here is not normal.
A short distance away, the jaguar was still eating the mother, bones still crunching.
But it is normal, Ramon Valdez said. It is the way things are.
Sanger did not want to talk about it anymore. Clearly, Valdez was an apologist for the industrialists and polluters, the big American companies that dominated Costa Rica and other Latin American countries. Not surprising to find such a person here, since the CIA had controlled Costa Rica for decades. This wasn't a country. It was a subsidiary of American business interests, and American businesses did not give a damn for the environment. Ramon Valdez said,
"The jaguars must eat, too. I think better a turtle than to take a human baby."
That, Mark Sanger thought, was a matter of opinion. Back at home in Berkeley, Sanger sat in his loft and pondered what to do. Although Sanger told people he was a biologist, he had no formal training in the field. He had attended 1 year of college before dropping out to work briefly for a landscape architecture firm, Cather and Holly. The only biology he had taken was a course in high school. The son of a banker, Sanger possessed a substantial trust fund and did not need to work to support himself. He did, however, need a purpose in life. Wealth, in his experience, made the quest for self-identity even more difficult, and the older he got, the harder it was to think about going back and finishing college. Recently, he had started to define himself as an artist. An artist did not need formal training. In fact, formal education interfered with the artist's ability to feel the zeitgeist, to ride the waves of change rolling through society, and to formulate a response to them. Sanger was very well informed in his opinion. He read the Berkeley papers, and sometimes magazines like Mother Jones and several of the environmental magazines. Not every month, but sometimes. True, he often just looked at the pictures, skimming the stories, but that was all that was necessary to track the zeitgeist. Art was about feeling, about how it felt to live in this materialistic world with its gaudy luxuries, false promises, and profound disappointments. What was wrong with people today was that they ignored their feelings. It was the job of art to bring true feelings alive, to shock people into awareness. That was why so many young artists were using genetic techniques and living material to create art. Wet art, they called it. Tissue art. Many artists now worked full-time in science labs, and the art that resulted was distinctly scientific. One artist had grown steaks in a petri dish and then ate them in public as a performance. Supposedly, they tasted awful. Anyway, they were genetically modified. Ugh. An artist in France had made a glowing bunny rabbit by inserting luminescent genes from a firefly or something. And still other artists had changed the hair color of animals, giving them rainbow hues, and had grown porcupine quills on the head of a cute puppy. These works of art provoked strong feelings. Many people were disgusted, but then, Sanger thought, they should be disgusted. They should feel the same revulsion that he himself had felt watching the slaughter of a mother turtle by a jaguar on a beach in Costa Rica. That horrid perversion of nature, that repellent savagery that he could not put out of his mind. And that, of course, was the reason to make art. Not art for art's sake, rather art to benefit the world, art to help the environment. That was Mark Sanger's goal, and he set about to attain it. Local doctor arrested for organ theft. Long